On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I think that the hardest part is actually being aware that you can do this, because once you're in contact with the milk bank, they make it really easy. You fill out a couple of forms, you take a couple of blood tests, and your obstetrician and your kid's pediatrician have to sign off, and then they send you a cooler, and then you send the milk right back.
Later in the show, the business of breast milk. But first, another mother's story. From 2009 to 2011, Anne Marie Slaughter worked in Washington as a top-level State Department employee under Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. But at the same time, her husband was struggling back at home in Princeton, New Jersey, with their older teenage son. He was acting out, getting suspended from school. He was even picked up by the police. So Anne Marie Slaughter has written that the crisis forced her to confront what was most important to her, and it led her to question the feminist narrative she grew up with. And she decided to leave her high-powered position at the State Department. A year later, she wrote an article for The Atlantic called Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And that article became the most read in the magazine's 150-year history. The article has now grown into a book, and it's called Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. And Anne Marie Slaughter joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
I'm so pleased to be here.
I'm so pleased to have you. Well, tell me about that it made you question the feminist narrative that you grew up believing in. What was that narrative?
That's probably the line in the article that got me into the most trouble, so I'm happy to talk about it. I mean, it meant, you know, really until then, I really did believe if you just wanted it enough, you could make work and family work. You could put them together. It was just a question of being committed enough to your career.
That you could have it all.
Yes. I now try to avoid that frame because I think it really does make us all sound selfish and callous mm-hmm. to the people who don't have enough. But yes, I mean, it was this idea that if I just wanted it enough, I could make it work. And I got to this moment where I realized this is not about my ambition or commitment to my career. This is about a choice that simply has to be made. You know, there's no way of fudging it. There, I cannot do both. I'm going to have to choose. And at that moment, it was very clear to me that the right choice was, you know, to go home and be with my son when he needed me. But until then, I would have regarded any woman who made that choice as not committed enough to her career.
This is despite the fact that you had a husband at home who had been, as he describes it, the lead parent. You were rarely home for dinner in years.
Yeah, although because I was on an academic schedule, we would go for long periods where I'd be home only a couple of days a week, and then we'd have, you know, a lot of time to catch it up. But yes, here I was with every advantage. You know, mm-hmm. I was relatively affluent. I had a husband who was being lead parent. And even so, I really needed to go home. And I'm careful to say, it's not that I went home and everything was perfect. That would be really unfair to my husband. But it was clear to both of us that we just kind of needed all hands on deck. We really needed to focus on this kid. And I'm happy to say he's just gone off to college.
But you didn't just stop working.
No, I mean, never.
I think what I remember most from that article was I thought you stepped back into something that seems more intense than anyone I know does. I mean, you still had a full-time job teaching at Princeton. You were lecturing,
yes.
Writing. I mean, it sounds like you had more than a full-time job when you decided to lean back.
That's right. And one of the things that led me to write the article and the book is how many people described me as dropping out or not being able to cut it or opting out. But all these ways of describing a return to a full-time, high-status job in the terms that we use for people who can't finish high school. And you get that with women all the time, right? You know, that she made a choice to put her family first is described as dropping or opting out. And that reflects, I think, a bias against care and taking care of your loved ones that in the book, I really say this is a deeper problem here. I mean, there's just no way that's dropping out.
Yeah. So when you left the State Department, what did you say? What was your official reason before you wrote the article?
I told people I was going home because of my kids. I've always talked about my children. I've always thought that was part of being a woman in power, was to make this acceptable that you are a powerful woman in a career, but you also have a family and you care about that. So I very deliberately told people I was home because I had two teenagers who are home for the last 4 years of their lives. I didn't go into details about my older son. I just said, this is why I'm home. And at that moment, I suddenly got these reactions that I'd never gotten before that were fundamentally, you know, oh, what a pity, and kind of a, I guess you're not really a player.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Anne-Marie Slaughter. She has a new book. It's called Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, and Family. For much of this book, you say that the next women's movement or the next phase in the women's movement really needs to be a men's movement.
Right.
And that we can talk about women being empowered and leaning in all we want, but until men fundamentally shift the way they view their lives and what's important to them, nothing's going to change.
I do think it's not enough. I mean, it's not enough because so many of us will hit tipping points. You know, you can't predict it, but if somebody with every advantage that I had hit a tipping point, plenty of other people do. But more fundamentally, you just can't have a halfway revolution. You can't change women's roles as fundamentally as we have and, you know, have them go from being caregivers and now breadwinners and not, you know, have men then fill that slack on the home front. You know, so if both do both, you've got a reasonable shot. And so really this does have to focus on men. And that is something I think is logically obvious, but we really resist. I think women resist it because they're uncomfortable with what that means for our spouses, and we have sort of very conventional notions of masculinity. And men actually, I think, want it, but they're scared too. You know, they're afraid that they will be looked down on by other men and by women.
So when they say, oh, I want to take time off to be at home with my new baby, they feel like they can't do that?
Yeah. I mean, they get teased, they get essentially told they're a sissy, that they're less of a man. And many men wrote to me. Some wrote to me and said, I have done this and I get ridiculed and, you know, my masculinity is called into question. And other men wrote me and said, I really want to do this, but my role is the breadwinner. And what I now think is we have not given a men a real chance to say what they want.
But plenty of companies in the white-collar sphere, they offer these family-friendly policies because they want to lure the top talent, and top talent wants to have what you're talking about. And so they do offer family leave policies. They do say, some in Silicon Valley say, take as much time as you want.
Yep.
We're not even going to limit your vacation. We're not going to limit your sick time. So isn't the private sector trying to encourage this?
So, you know, I think there are companies that are doing very well. And there's I talk about an organization called openwork.org where you can go and see lots of different companies that really do have policies that work. But so many of these flexibility policies are really paper policies, because the next question you should ask when a company is telling you about its great policy is how many senior executives took that policy and how many men took that policy. And if the answer is, well, nobody actually who made it into a leadership position took that policy, then you know full well that that's for the losers. You know, and that's that is not what
we're talking
about.
But whose fault is that? Why aren't they taking these positions or this time off? Why aren't they doing that?
Because it's hypocritical. They basically believe that to succeed in their firm, you have to be single-mindedly committed to your career, and you cannot work any differently, work any less, take part-time, you know, not show up early and leave late. And that's still the old model of how you succeed. And so they put in these policies, but they're for other people.
Now, we've been talking about privileged women and men,
yes,
by and large,
yes,
in this conversation. But of course, the vast majority of the workforce, they don't get to choose.
Right.
They don't get to talk
right
about work-life balance. They just have to make a living.
Yep.
I mean, how do you address that? That what you're talking about is for, you know, a privileged few.
Absolutely. The real problem in the country is too few women at the top and far too many at the bottom. Because, in fact, you know, the poorest members of our society are single mothers who are trying to take care of kids and work at the same time. And a majority of minimum wage workers and two-thirds of shift workers are women. So if we're really going to advance women, then we have to have policies that advance all women. And that brings us back to discrimination against caregiving, because then suddenly you realize, well, if you're at the top and you take time out for care, that's a black mark on your resume. And it's hard to get back in. And if you're at the bottom, you can lose your job, you can get docked in pay, you won't get promoted. So that's where actually, you know, the book comes out saying we need a set of policies that, frankly, wealthy white women tend to buy their way out of, because we can afford daycare, we can work this out. But for most women, you need paid family leave, we need maternity and paternity leave, and we need, you know, high-quality, affordable childcare.
What does it say to you that we have had this conversation in one form or another for maybe 50 years in this country, and not a lot has changed when it comes to official policies?
Yes.
I mean, we have unpaid family leave.
That's right.
And yet there have been massive changes in other areas in our country, gay rights, for example.
Exactly. You know, in this book, I really am saying because we're just focusing too much on women, and we're not recognizing that what happened was we liberated women, but traditional women's work is still completely devalued. So you can't say men and women are equal, but, you know, that care stuff that women used to do, that's not important. That income stuff that men did, that is. Again, that's a stuck revolution. So I actually think if we focus on care and we focus on men, that's the, you know, the second half of the revolution. That's the unfinished business. And I'm optimistic just because millennials want these kinds of changes. I think lots of men want these kinds of changes. And I also think as a society, care and support for care is becoming a work issue. It's a middle class issue about how do you fit work together with having families. And that is now a question of how do you support a middle class lifestyle.
You are a foreign policy expert.
Yes. You wouldn't know it, but yes.
Well, I know. And so that leads to my question that you are now best known for talking about this.
Yes.
What does that say to you that we're not talking about your foreign policy expertise right now?
Well, in one way, it's just this is an area in which everyone's an expert, right? Foreign policy really is a very specialized area of expertise. This is an area where anyone who has a child or a parent or a sick spouse, you know, we've all been there. So it's not surprising that many, many more people would read me on this than on what we should do in Syria.
But do you feel like without the foreign policy credentials that you wouldn't be taken as seriously talking about this?
Yes. I absolutely did not expect the reaction to my article. But I did know that if, as the former dean of the Woodrow Wilson School, as Hillary Clinton's advisor, if I wrote this article, it would have more weight.
All right. Should there be a President Clinton, and she calls you up and says, Anne Marie, I want you back in, would you join her administration?
You know, I would love to see a woman president. I run a nonpartisan think tank, so I'm going to say that. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, I'm committed to New America at the moment, and I'm not making any plans. But I would love to be back in foreign policy at some point.
So you'd say yes to a State Department role. What if she said, I want a domestic policy czar, someone who can put these ideas you wrote about in the book into practice? What would you say to that?
I'd say there are a lot of people better qualified to do that than I am. There really are. They're all, and one of the things I do in the book is to highlight the work of just fabulous scholars and activists who have been in these trenches for so long. And I got the platform, but they would be the people who were really expert in making this happen.
Well, Anne-Marie Slaughter, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for coming in today.
Likewise. I really enjoyed it.
That's Anne-Marie Slaughter. Her new book is called Unfinished Business, Women, Men, Work, Family. Coming up, what is it like to be married to one of TV's most successful showrunners? A man whose wife has won Emmys has written a novel about being the plus one. That's next on Press Play.
Browse the KCRW store and shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and merchandise. Shop to support KCRW only at kcrw.com/store.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'm joined in the studio by Christopher Noxon. He's the author of a new novel. It's called Plus One. And I should also mention that Christopher is married to Jenji Kohan, creator of the successful TV shows Weeds and, of course, Orange is the New Black. And because of Jenji's success and long hours, Christopher has taken on more of the homemaker role in the marriage. They have three children. And I mention that because in his new book, Plus One, the main character, Alex, is married to the creator of a hit TV show. He quits his day job and he takes over the homemaking duties. Christopher Noxon, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
Now, there is a lot of ambivalence, obviously, in the book. That's part of the tension, the comedic tension. And the book, by the way, is very funny. Over this idea of your character, Alex, being a house husband. And I think at one point, you know, he really doesn't like that term. His term is...
He likes to be called a domestic first responder.
And I say your character because, you know...
He's close. He's close. He's sort of a version of me. He's not me. And this is not a thinly veiled expose of our lives at all. I sort of took the basic facts of our life and then kind of unspooled all the insecurities and anxieties and places that I thought story could go. You know, I found myself in this position where I was looking after the kids and the house and being a support player to my wife, and I felt really great about it. And on the other hand, I had all these weird lingering insecurities and sort of like just contained aggressions coming out, and I started writing about it.
And when did that first start?
A couple years ago. I mean, after Jenji's show, really, the Weeds kind of took off, and at that point, I had written a book, and I was doing some consulting, but the money that I was bringing in just all of a sudden didn't really matter in our family, and it was sort of like, okay, well, what do I really want to do? So I started writing. I wrote an essay about like what it's like to go to the Emmys with a woman as the sort of plus one. And then I started thinking about like, what do I really want to write? And what I wanted to write was a story, like not essays, but just a real juicy story about, you know, men kind of coming to grips with being householders and support people, and women as breadwinners, and all the tensions around those changing roles.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of took our own life and then kind of went way beyond anything that has ever happened to us, because I felt like that's where the real story would be.
Well, you start the book off at the Emmys, your character. I'm just going to keep calling him your character.
It's all right.
Alex is super excited for his wife. She's nominated for an Emmy, and it's a really exciting moment for them. And then she wins, and that's sort of the beginning of the end, in a sense. That's when he realizes things are never going to be the same. And it's kind of symbolized in a scene where his shoes start falling apart.
Yeah, it's after she wins the Emmy, they go outside into one of those press tents, and he's walking down the red carpet, and he starts to feel something weird under his foot, and he looks down, and he sees that the sole of his shoe is peeling away. And the shoes had been given to him by Figgy, who got them at a thrift shop, his wife Figgy. And so he asks her, where did these shoes come from? And it turns out that she bought them at the County Morgue thrift shop. And they're corpse shoes and never made to hold the weight of a living man. I did not make this story up. This story actually happened to me the first time that Jenji and I went to the Emmys in 1999. This really did happen to me. But this happened in a very different way. It was in a limousine on the way there. The shoes started to fall apart. And in real life, Jenji ran and found a gaffer and fixed my shoes for me. And it was
with
duct tape. And it was beautiful. It was this, and it made the whole night fantastic, because I had this like badge of outsiderness that made me feel really special. In the book, it happens and she doesn't even pay any attention to him. And this guy materializes out of the crowd, who's married to one of her actors, and he tapes him up and saves the day.
Well, let's talk about that guy. His name is Huck. In your book,
right.
And he's kind of a charter member of the Plus Ones, and he sort of inducts Alex into that world.
Yeah, I mean, where Alex is very ambivalent about the place he has, Huck is totally all in. Like, he is an expert manscaper, and he's like a gearhead chef. And I've met a couple of guys like this who decide, okay, I'm going to be house husband, well, I'm just going to be the best version of that possible. I'm going to take cordon bleu classes. I'm going to do workout with Sensei Tim. You know, I feel like for Huck, you know, in the book, it's pretty obvious by the end that he's not at home and not at peace, mm-hmm. and that he's displacing a lot of his anxiety into these external things. And he's actually wanting to blow up his life.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Christopher Noxon. He's written a new novel. It's called Plus One. Huck also brings up this idea of the 10-year law. And Alex has no idea what he's talking about. This is a real thing in California.
Yeah, it is. As I understand it, and I've spoken to a couple of divorce lawyers,
the 10-year law. Information,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
It's also known as the Tom Cruise law, right? Because apparently Tom Cruise divorced Nicole Kidman at like 9 years and 11 months or something. Uh-huh. The rule is that if you're married after 10 years, you split alimony for the rest of your lives, that it's indefinite.
Until they remarry.
What often happens is people don't remarry because they can get half of that unless there's a prenup. So in the book, what happens is Alex is close to the 10-year and Huck is urging him to stick it out so he can pass the 10-year mark so that he can get past that sort of artificial line. So prop up the marriage, do whatever you can, get past 10 and then split. It's pretty horrible. But I
know. Have you had conversations like that in real life?
Myself, not. I haven't had that conversation in terms of my own marriage. But I have heard people having those conversations, sure.
Men.
And women, mostly women. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've heard women talking about it in terms of their husbands.
That they need to stay with their husbands or that they need to get rid of them before 10 years?
Yes, oh. The latter.
Wow. Woo.
Yeah, I mean, it's ugly. It's
that
ugly.
Is, yeah.
And the fact that that sort of artificial law can affect the most intimate relationship that you have is really spooky and creepy. And very LA.
Okay, this seems like a good opportunity to get you to read a little bit from the book. If you wouldn't mind the segment where he is flirting with a much younger woman who seems kind of interested in
Miranda him. Miranda the Butcher.
And they're at a party and take it from there.
Okay. So Miranda says, doesn't she have another show coming up? I saw that thing on Deadline yesterday, something about Russian brides. Smart, taking care of family planning before starting another project.
They're talking about his impending vasectomy.
Yes, he's about to get snipped the next day. Alex felt his face go hot. Mention of the show was bad enough. He got a quick visual of Figgy and the Rasta actor Franklin Sykes lounging in a cast trailer. Even worse was the way that Miranda had just assumed that his vasectomy, which he'd come to think of as a brave, independent act, was all Figgy's doing. Like she was sending him in for neutering, as if he wasn't neutered enough. Actually, I'm the one gearing up for the work right now, he heard himself say. The show I've been developing, it just got a pickup. We're about to go into production. What? I didn't know. You're in TV too? Afraid so. I fell into it. Old colleague of mine asked if I'd EP his new syndicated show. Alternative programming. Reality. But not horrible. Really, no one has approached the dog space quite like this before.
The dog's face.
And it's a totally made-up thing. I mean, the backstory there is that his father-in-law has come to him with this crazy idea for a show about dog trainers, and he's sort of blown him off. But in that moment where this young, very attractive butcher sort of confronts him with it, all of a sudden that becomes his life's mission.
So he's not doubling down on the plus one identity. He wants to create his own separate identity from Figgy.
Yeah, and I think that's human and male, and I totally get that. I don't know many people who are completely satisfied with a support role. It's a very brave and incredibly admirable position to play. But I think we all need, especially in this town, but I think we all need something to call our own that feels real and creative and something.
Yeah.
Besides, you know, wiping up the faces and driving the carpools and arranging the trips. That's a hard role to play 100% of the time.
So when Genji, your real wife, read this book, did she learn anything about how you were feeling about your marriage and your role?
I mean, she was had some misgivings at first throughout this whole process because she thought that everyone was going to read this as an expose, that they would just assume it's all true. But as she read it, I think she began to sort of realize how different it is from, well, I mean, it's different and true. The one thing she did really say is that it was frightening to see a very real depiction of a marriage right up to the brink. I had to sort of imagine what it would be like to have that fight with your wife that you never come back from. In the first draft of the book, it wasn't there, and some people read it, and they were like, there's something missing, and I realized I skipped it. I skipped the crisis point in a marriage where you're fighting until 3 in the morning, and you're exhausted, and you start to really imagine what it would be like to break a family up. That's something that Genji and I had not experienced, and I had to put myself into that role, and when she read that, I think she got really freaked out. It's like, oh. But in some ways, I think it was reassuring because that's not our marriage. But it's tricky to follow that emotional train as deeply as you can go and yet come back.
Yeah. Well, how is it that your marriage didn't go there? I mean, because it obviously has happened to a lot of Hollywood marriages where someone gets fame and fortune and is away all the time and traveling and working, and the other person, they grow apart and they end it.
I mean, why are Genji and I still together? She's my best friend. I love her in a way that I don't think that Alex loves Figgy. I'm not Alex, in that Alex is a sort of, he's described as this marketing executive, and he wants to write this punk rock memoir, and he hasn't grown up, I think, to the degree that maybe I have. I can see him pretty clearly as a little bit more insecure than I am. I'm also a writer, right? I have a thing. I've been doing this for a long time. And Alex doesn't have that. So I'm a little bit more secure than I think Alex is.
Okay, I have to ask this question because, well, it's Hollywood. Has this been optioned, plus one?
It has been optioned for a TV show, and I'm writing the pilot, you know, like everybody else in L.A.
Well,
I'm writing a half-hour pilot for ABC right now. We'll see if it ever becomes a TV show.
Would she produce it?
No, and that was very important to me. That as I wrote it and developed it and pitched it, that it was completely outside of her. And there was actually one point at which, you know, I've never written a TV show in my life, and there was some concern that I wouldn't be able to do it. And at one point, one of the network executives is like, could you maybe get Genji to executive produce? I was like, did you read the book? You know, maybe start there. I thought it was really important that it stands on its own. And if it fails, it fails. If it succeeds, it succeeds. But I didn't want to have the taint or the influence of like this was under her banner. It's called Plus One. The whole point is this guy has to stand on his own feet.
So who's going to be your Plus One at the Golden Globes or the Emmys?
Her, of course.
Of course.
She's brought me along. I'm going to have to make her suffer.
She's going to carry your bag.
That's right. I'm going to start carrying an extra glittery handbag.
Well, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Christopher Noxon. His new novel is called Plus One. Coming up, when writer Eula Biss had a baby, she was overwhelmed by fears about the government, the medical establishment, and the contents of her child's air and food.
And I found myself nervous and skeptical and wondering about this technology and whether the fears I was hearing were legitimate and fears that I should be concerned about.
Eula Biss on immunity, but first, the business of breast milk. We'll have that story after a news update.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. In a nation that commodifies just about everything, you can add human breast milk to the list. When new mothers and hospitals need breast milk for newborns, they traditionally get it from nonprofit milk banks. These milk banks get their milk donated by women who pump more than their babies need. But these days, websites like Only the Breast and Eats on Feets allow women to sell or trade their extra breast milk. And it doesn't always go to babies. It's now a fad among bodybuilders. In nearby City of Industry, a huge new breast milk facility plans to process 3.4 million ounces of breast milk this year. The company, Prolacta, creates a concentrated product for premature babies that it sells to hospitals for about $180 an ounce. Pauline Sakamoto is a registered nurse and the executive director of Mother's Milk Bank in San Jose, and that's one of 18 nonprofit milk banks in North America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Also joining us, Dr. Mark Underwood, chief of neonatology at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And also Elizabeth Currid Halkett, associate professor of public policy at USC, and also a milk donor. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And let me begin with you, Elizabeth, and tell me about why you decided to donate your extra breast milk.
Well, I'm really lucky. I didn't have any trouble with breastfeeding, and I had a lot of milk from the beginning, and I also had great maternity leave, and so all of the milk that I had stored, I realized I was never going to use it. And I think I asked like a friend of mine who had also breastfed her kids, you know, was there a way to give it away? And at the time, I was actually quite naive. I didn't even know if it was something people would want. And she said yes. So then I actually emailed my son's doctor, and I said, is there like a way to do this? And he got me in touch with the people at Children's Hospital who use human milk, and they got me in touch with the Mother's Milk Bank in San Jose.
And for you, is it a fairly simple process, or is it something that is kind of cumbersome?
It's really straightforward for me. I think that the hardest part is actually being aware that you can do this, because once you're in contact with the milk bank, they make it really easy. You fill out a couple of forms, you take a couple of blood tests, and your obstetrician and your kid's pediatrician have to sign off, and then they send you a cooler, and then you send the milk right back. And so it's an hour to sort of start the process and about 5 minutes every time you donate milk.
All right, so let's go to the next step in the supply chain, to the milk bank. Pauline Sakamoto, executive director of Mother's Milk Bank. And so do you have a lot of mothers like Elizabeth who have extra milk and they want to do something good for others?
Yes, we do. We routinely, daily, we have about 100 to 120 moms who are on our list who want to donate just like Elizabeth. They go through the same testing mode as all the other milk banks in the U.S. and Canada. We're very standardized in our testing requirements. And once we receive the milk, then it is kept frozen at a particular temperature, and then we thaw it and we pasteurize it. We also bacteria test the milk, and then it's ready to go out. And we have about 104 hospitals that we serve in 13 states. So Elizabeth's milk may go to any hospital in any of our areas, but we're always looking for more milk.
So do you have enough supply to meet the demand?
You know, it's interesting because we seem to find the donors, but the demand keeps increasing. Every month we tend to pick up two more hospitals who are in need of donor milk and who've never used it before. So we're constantly looking for new donors. And unlike blood donors, where once you donate blood, you know, you can go back for a lifetime, human milk is just one short period of time in your life that you can donate milk.
Okay, so now there are these for-profit companies. I mentioned one, Prolacta. There's also Medolac. They buy breast milk for, I think, between $1 and $4 an ounce. Is that cutting into your supply?
So by numbers sake, we don't see a real huge deficit at this point, but I believe there are certain areas in our country where they do a prolific amount of advertising that we're seeing a decrease in volume.
And do you charge a fee to the hospitals?
In California right now, our charge is $3.75 an ounce, and that covers all our costs to service the moms who are giving the milk. We give them breast milk bags and the shipping costs and the blood test and so forth. So that seems to cover our costs pretty well.
Okay, let's move to the final end of the supply chain. Dr. Mark Underwood, chief of neonatology at UC Davis Children's Hospitals in Sacramento. And you take some milk from Mother's Milk Bank?
We do indeed. We're one of those hospitals that just in the last 2 years has move to using more and more donor breast milk. And so our goal is to use a mother's own milk anytime that's possible. But in general, we place an order to the San Jose Milk Bank 3 to 4 times a year and try to keep a little bit ahead of the supply.
And this is for premature babies.
That's right. The babies that benefit the most from human milk are premature babies. Babies who get human milk, if they're born prematurely, have a lower risk of infection and a lower risk of a common and devastating disease. It has a long name. It's called necrotizing enterocolitis. And we know that if a baby gets human milk, their risk of getting this horrible disease goes down by about half.
Well, talk a little bit, if you will, about the entrance of these for-profit companies. They charge $180 an ounce, and as we just heard, mother's milk is $3.75 an ounce. Why the difference?
So when we're giving human milk, whether it's milk that the mom has pumped for her own baby or milk that another mom has donated, we have to add some fortifiers to that milk in order for it to have enough nutrition for a premature infant to grow and thrive. I can use a commercial product that comes from cow milk, or I can turn to a product made by Prolacta where they're actually concentrating human milk to make it a fortifier that can be added to mom's own milk to increase its nutritional value. That process, as I understand from talking with the folks at Prolacta, has been very expensive and is part of the reason that they charge so much.
And in the interest of full disclosure, I want to say that we reached out to Prolacta as well as another for-profit company, Medolac, and the website Only the Breast. None of them wanted to come on this show. So this fortified Prolacta product is probably superior to the other kind of fortifier because it doesn't contain the cow's milk, so it doesn't contribute to this disease that you'd mentioned, NEC.
I think you're right that it probably is superior, though the studies that have been published so far have still been fairly small. And so I think the answer is still unclear there.
And Pauline Sakamoto, is that something that you've considered, is trying to pursue this fortified milk end of the market?
We need to provide milk not only for the preterm infant, but also to the outpatient children that are failing to thrive. And we just aren't collecting enough. And we really want to make sure that the women in the U.S. have the opportunity and the skill sets and the support to continue their breastfeeding.
Let's turn to one of those moms again, Elizabeth Currid Halkett. You donate to Mother's Milk Bank. And now that there are these for-profit companies out there that would buy your milk for $1 to $4 an ounce, did you ever consider doing that?
No. It feels like one of those things you shouldn't make money from. I mean, I think as a mom who has two very healthy children, every day of my life, I'm like so grateful for that. And it feels just like the very least I can do to give back to humanity is give this thing that money can't really buy. I would just say that women who are in my position, which is that they don't need to sell milk and they have generous maternity leave, that this is something that they can do to really make a difference in other babies' lives.
And Dr. Underwood, do you worry that the entrance of these companies and the market for breast milk might have a deleterious effect when it comes to women and their own babies, that they would maybe be encouraged to sell their milk rather than give it to their own babies?
I do have that concern. I think on a bigger scale, if we think about our population of our most vulnerable and yet most promising people, that's babies, and to make sure they get a good start and the best nutrition they can is really a societal priority, or should be. And so having a conversation like we are, I think, is a wonderful first step to make sure that we're making the best use we can of this precious and limited resource. For instance, if we have moms who make a decision to not pump their own milk for their preemie because they have this sense of, oh, they can just get milk from a donor milk bank, that would be a mistake. We know pretty clearly that a baby will benefit more from his mother's own milk than from donor milk that has to be pasteurized. On the other side of the scale, if we have a mom who is willing to go through the sacrifice of saying, I'll pump and donate my extra, and that ends up going into a stream that doesn't end up reaching the baby's most at need, that would be unfortunate.
And Pauline Sakamoto at Mother's Milk Bank, what do you worry about ethically as this becomes more of a business?
You know, I think that the types of businesses of women selling their milk on the internet and sharing milk, there really isn't a way to regulate or have access to what is really going on out there. You know, we're regulated, and the FDA watches over us and how we do what we do. And the internet process that's going on right now, there's no regulatory bodies. So that, to me, is worrisome. I worry about the safety.
Yeah, there was also news out recently that a significant portion of milk online tested, had cow's milk in it.
Yes, that was pretty astonishing.
How do we compare with other countries when it comes to this issue, providing donated breast milk?
Well, I think, you know, for the U.S. in comparison with other, you know, industrialized nations, we're pretty slow in the number of milk banks. And, for example, India, you know, picked up 17 milk banks in 3 years because of government support.
And just by comparison, there are 18 total in the U.S. and Canada?
Actually, in the U.S., there's less than 18 because you're talking about 18 in North America. So yeah. There's three in Canada. And we are, you know, at this point developing six more milk banks that are coming up probably in the next year and a half. But you look at Brazil, for example, that has 234 milk banks, and their fire department supports milk banking, and the milk is free. You know, any physician that needs it gets it, or any mother that the baby is failing to thrive. So we're kind of behind.
And I want to end with Elizabeth Currid Halkett, our milk donor. How long are you going to do this? I mean, you're just one woman, but how long are you going to continue donating?
As long as I'm breastfeeding, and I breastfed my first child till he was two, and I imagine my second child will certainly breastfeed him at least a year. And while I'm doing it, I will continue to give milk to the Mother's Milk Bank. And I actually think one of the interesting things is I think a lot of other mothers would do this too if they were aware. I think really for a lot of moms, it's actually being aware that we can do that, because after that, it's fairly straightforward.
Okay. We'll end it there. I want to thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Elizabeth Currid Halkett. She teaches at USC and she's a milk donor. Also, we heard from Pauline Sakamoto. She's a registered nurse and the executive director of Mother's Milk Bank in San Jose. And we also heard from Dr. Mark Underwood, chief of neonatology at UC Davis Children's Hospital in Sacramento. Coming up, it's flu vaccine season, and writer Eula Biss is here to talk about her book On Immunity. She tackles practical and philosophical questions about inoculation and tries to figure out why some wealthy, educated parents are turning away from vaccines for their children. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcast you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. So the vaccine debate has gone political. It's become a public issue. But for most parents, it's an intensely personal decision. What's best for their children? Essayist Eula Biss's book about vaccination starts in a very personal space, her own questions about giving her child vaccines. But she ends up believing that a mother's decision to vaccinate her child is not personal at all. Her book is called On Immunity and Inoculation.
Once I became pregnant, I suddenly became attuned to all the concerns and fears out there. And I found myself nervous and skeptical and wondering about this technology and whether the fears I was hearing were legitimate and fears that I should be concerned about.
But the people who don't vaccinate are largely white, well-educated, and well-off. Mothers like,
yeah, they're
like
more
you.
Likely to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so why do you think this privileged group is questioning the value of vaccines?
I do think part of it is an extension of privilege, and that people who are accustomed in other parts of their lives to being able to have things that other people don't have and being safe from risks that other people are subject to. For instance, when you don't vaccinate, you're refusing to participate in a system of shared risk. And while you're drawing the benefits and rewards of everyone else participating in that system, it's very like to me the way that, for instance, the wealthy 1% in this country draws on resources from the rest of the society.
You also write that it's interesting because the people who don't vaccinate, they don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as anti-establishment or anti-capitalistic.
Yeah.
Or
often, yeah,
liberal.
As renegades.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that's the stance that I began with, was a kind of anti-establishment stance. And I'm not going to do this just because the state tells me to stance. And the more I thought about it and the more I looked into it and the more I learned about vaccination, the more I felt that I wasn't actually being anti-establishment if I didn't vaccinate, but that I was being in some ways antisocial.
Hmm.
It's kind of like a new kind of isolationism, an isolationism within the home.
Yeah, and I guess it's that suspicion of the things we can't see, the air, the water, you know, what's in our food, what's in our vaccines. I mean, we can't see the inoculation. And there's a fear there that that could be poison, that there's poison all around us. So why should we trust big government? Why should we trust big pharma? Why should we trust the medical establishment, which has been wrong on many cases in the past?
And I think that these are legitimate concerns, especially if you make the comparison with air and water. We know that there are pollutants in our air and water that are not being well regulated by the government. So it's a kind of easy extension of that thinking to assume that the government is also failing in its oversight of vaccines and that there's weak controls on vaccines as well. But that's really not the case. Thankfully, vaccine is very well regulated, and we would be much better off as a society if our air and water was as well regulated as our vaccines are.
Your book is really also a personal reflection on your own journey in terms of how you regard immunity and inoculation and our place in the larger body politic, if you will. Did you come to these realizations after you had a difficult birth with your son? I mean, the birth was fun, but right after that, you had a very life-threatening problem when your uterus inverted and you lost lots and lots of blood.
Yeah, I think it was a slow epiphany, but it was certainly touched off by that experience of being suddenly very dependent on the medical system. I lost a lot of blood very quickly and was very grateful to get extremely prompt medical care and also to get a donation of blood from an anonymous donor. Even just that act alone set me thinking about donation and this whole system that we have in this country for blood donation, where people give anonymously and willingly and without coercion. And they give something that they don't have to give that's essential to other people. I began thinking about immunity in those terms and what we give or donate when we agree to take on the risk of being vaccinated. And in my mind, it became a very fair comparison to compare it to blood donation and to think about the act as an act of generosity towards one's fellow citizens, an anonymous act like blood donation. You don't know who you're helping when you vaccinate yourself, and you probably will never know.
I think a lot of mothers who choose not to vaccinate, they don't think that they're being selfish, or they don't think that they're walling themselves off necessarily. I think what they're thinking of is, I'm trying to do the best thing for my child.
Yeah. It's the problem with that is that it's underexamined. So I don't think there's anything wrong with wanting to make the best decision for your child. But I do think that all the decisions that you make, especially when that decision involves going counter to the recommendations of made by the government and the American Association of Pediatrics and your family doctor and a number of other people, when you're countering those recommendations, I think it's incumbent on you to examine your decision very carefully.
Now that you've gone through all this research and written this book, I'm wondering, how do you have these conversations with mothers like you who don't vaccinate or just under-vaccinate or space out the vaccinations? How do you have these conversations without them devolving into? Because it's almost like talking about religion at a certain point. Everyone's got their studies. Everyone's got their evidence. It does come down to belief for both groups, which side you're going to believe.
You know, as a teacher and an educator, I have a belief in people's ability to learn and change. I see it all the time. I work with students who come in thinking one thing and walk out of my class thinking something different. One of my closest readers, someone who edited this book for me, was a mother of a young child who had made different decisions than I had around vaccination. And we talked about this subject endlessly because we met and exchanged work. She's also a writer. And those conversations were never acrimonious, though they were sometimes intense conversations in which we both had to think hard about why we'd made the decisions we made and what our motivations were.
And was she convinced? Or were you convinced,
you know,
in any way?
There was an interesting moment when she and I were actually going to travel together. We were traveling to France, and there was a huge measles epidemic there. And I mentioned that to her because I knew that her daughter was not vaccinated against measles. And she wasn't concerned. She wasn't scared for her child or herself. But the other thing I mentioned to her was the most common way that measles enters the United States these days is from an unvaccinated child who's traveled abroad and brought it back. And that made her vaccinate her child. It wasn't that she was scared for her child's health. It was that she didn't want to be in the position of having been the person who brought measles back to the United States. And I have a lot of respect for that. I think that that's similar to my own reasons for vaccinating. I don't live in daily fear of infectious diseases, but I do feel responsibility towards my fellow citizens.
Eula Biss, her new book is called On Immunity and Inoculation. It's been such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, that's it for us. Stay tuned for War and Almy and To the Point. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.